Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, we're going to talk about the post-election analysis from the Justice Party's perspective. I'm also going to be sharing some new information from WikiLeaks on the Yemen files and unmasking Washington's bloody role. Also, one of the Ukrainian nationalist leaders that the United States and our State Department supports says, quote, ISIS is our ally in the struggle against Russia, end quote. Really? Then why hasn't the media been on top of this? Well, then it might find out that we help support the coup in the Ukraine to begin with. Also, I'm going to give some input about Castro's death. I haven't had an opportunity at this point, but mine's a little different in that I have to look at what he represented as an individual in power for himself, his family, and the people of Cuba, both constructive and negative. Then you can make up your own mind. But the difference is that a lot of people, especially in the liberal community, think he is a savior, a saint, a person who created a workers' paradise in Cuba. And as long as you were going to their meetings, hanging out with them, and listening to their perspective, you would have thought the same thing in all probability. On the other hand, we were told that he was a demon, he was a tyrant, he was a killer, ruthless, opportunist, he was a psychopath. So I decided to go to Cuba and find out for myself. And I did. And I spent a lot of time there. And I had a chance staying completely away from the tourist places and the hotels, but staying with the Cuban people and having the good fortune of having a top physician be my guide the first week, and a person who was high up at the highest levels of the intelligence community the second week. And they had some very revealing things to share with me, as did hundreds of people I interviewed. I'll share all that today. We're also going to look at why we still have a disastrous war on drugs, and also the brazen way that the charter school industry rips you off and how they're getting their people lined up to become the new Secretary of Education. But that's true for virtually every department of our government. Major corporatists have their people in every single position. My guest today is Rocky Anderson from Salt Lake City, Utah. He was the 2012 presidential candidate for the National Justice Party, which he was instrumental in founding. He is a former two-term mayor of Salt Lake City, and he served from 2000 to 2008, and he's the executive director for the organization High Road for Human Rights. He was a former member of the Democratic Party. He left over its evisceration of the Constitution and it having morphed into a poor alternative to the GOP. He is highly critical of both the Bush and Obama administrations, and now with the election of Donald Trump and his cabinet nominations, we'll see what he thinks. And prior to entering politics, Rocky practiced law in Utah for 21 years and was listed among the best lawyers in America. In fact, a Business Week listed him as one of the top 20 activists on climate change, and he has received many awards from various environmental organizations. His website, rockyanderson.org, and the Justice Party's website is justicepartyusa.org. Nice to have you with us again, Rocky.
Gary, it's great to be with you. It's been a long time.
Rocky, you're a former Democrat who resigned because of the change in the focus. And during this election, we saw the worst of the Democratic Party. First, there was the corruption within its national committee to marginalize Bernie Sanders. Now, WikiLeaks gave us this information, so it wasn't hearsay. And it showed that Hillary Clinton, all of her top aides, all were involved in it. Podesta, everyone knew that this was going on. Now, that led to several points I would like you to address. One, shouldn't that been given a legal opportunity for Bernie Sanders and his whole support team to stop and say, hold on a second, then we deserve a recount in these states where clearly we had the majority, and yet you ended up winning. Or at the very least, say, what kind of party is the Democratic Party that I'm leading all these young millennials and idealists into? If he really cared about these people, the millions who supported him, who saw him as a senior spokesperson, as a wise man, and who could help them on at least 12 major issues, he was very progressive. On about 20 issues, he was very regressive. But on those important issues, those were the issues important to them. And yet, instead of challenging Clinton in the media, he didn't say a word about it, didn't sue. Instead, when he lost the nomination, he then went to work for her, bringing everyone into the Democratic tent. Now, as a former Democrat, and as someone who sees that you cannot change these institutions because it's codified by corruption and self-interest and special usage, you're not dealing with one woman, Hillary Clinton, or her husband, Bill Clinton, or Obama. You're dealing with thousands upon thousands of people that they hire when they're in office, and then the tens of thousands of corporations that benefit from getting contracts or special favors when they're in power. So you're dealing with a whole industry, and that's why the media, which is substantially influenced by the same politics, was not critical, did not expose any of these contradictions or inconsistencies. I was particularly taken by the fact that Bernie Sanders had one single moment where he could have said, I'm going to run as a third party, and could have. He could have worked with Jill Stein. He chose not to. That told me a lot about him. That said, I'd like your insights now, please, on all these topics.
Well, you've raised a lot there. First of all, regarding your comments concerning this idolatry toward Castro, I think people, and mostly on the left we're talking about right now, they need to stay true to principle when it comes to human rights, and they need to face up to the truth. A lot of us, probably you and I in particular, would have been imprisoned in Castro's Cuba had we spoken out against him and his government like we do against our government and our presidents. All you have to look at, you don't need to go to either right or left journals. Go to Human Rights Watch. Google it. Human Rights Watch condemned the authoritarianism of that government for decades in Cuba, how repressive it was, how many thousands of people were put in horrible prison conditions and made to suffer for many, many years because of their resistance against Castro. Also, of course, some people being killed because of their resistance. So it was a brutal regime. There's no getting around that. And sure, they had their different tiers of medical services. And if you were a tourist, it looked like everything was wonderful because you were pumping money into their economy. You could go over for your breast augmentation or your other cosmetic surgeries. And you'd come back thinking, oh, what a wonderful place that is and how nice their medical facilities are. That isn't at all what the vast majority of the Cuban people found. Now they did have they bragged about their improvements on infant mortality, and I read one report that said they were just behind the United States. So the United States has one of the worst infant mortality rates in the industrialized world because of lack of access to prenatal care. So that's not saying a whole lot. Now, when it comes to the need for a third party in this country, Gary, I think what we need is a second party because there is, although, I mean, you'll see a lot of differences, of course, on a lot of social issues, same kind of wedge issues that Republicans have been so ready to exploit over the years that serves them so well, things like abortion or their resistance to gay and lesbian rights, although I think the polls have completely changed on them in that area. But the slavish conduct of both of these parties toward Wall Street and their financier sponsors is what brought us to the brink with the economic meltdown. It cost millions of people enormous diminution in their retirement funds, their pensions. It cost hundreds of thousands of people their homes. Some people are still reeling economically because of what happened to our economy, and we've still got the worst disparity in both income and wealth than at any time in our nation's history since the Gilded Age in the late 1800s. And that was brought to us in large part by a Democratic Party that no longer serves the middle class or working people. And that case has been made in remarkable fashion by Thomas Frank in his excellent book, Listen Liberal, which provides the anatomy of how we got to where we are right now and what has happened to what used to be the party of the people. And so I think this is a time very much like what our nation saw with the Whig Party. The Whigs fell apart. They were one of the two major parties at the time, but they fell apart because of major disagreements among their members concerning slavery in the territories. And so it basically imploded, and then we saw in the North Lincoln's Republican Party come to power, and in the South they had the Know-Nothing Party, and that really was their name. But I think we're at that moment, but it's not necessarily just one party. I think there are a lot of Republicans that have completely had it with this craziness in the Republican Party. I think there are a lot of good, moderate Republicans that are ready to say, as my parents would have said if they were alive today, that's the end. They can't support a party that would have Trump as their nominee and that would back, blindly back, the kinds of things that Trump's about to do to our nation and to millions of people around the world. I mean, if he does even a fraction of what he claimed he was going to do with regard to Muslims, I mean, think of the backlash. Talk about chickens coming home to roost after, we've already seen so much of that with our disregard and mistreatment of the Muslim world in the past. Imagine if, with Donald Trump coming out with his anti-Muslim comments and his threat to register every Muslim in this country and to basically foreclose most Muslims from coming into this country, if he's going to take any of the steps that he's threatened to do to send millions of people packing, along with their families who have been here leading law-abiding lives, who are here simply to work and provide for their families. And I'm talking about immigrants and primarily from Mexico. So I think that we can all not just point the finger of blame, certainly at Trump, because we expect to have people like Trump, but the most dangerous aspect of our society, and you see this in a lot of societies, is the people that, as Noam Chomsky talked about, the people that look like they're, you know, the well-respected, dignified, sane people that empower people like Donald Trump. It was no different, and I know these analogies are usually, they really fall flat and sometimes seem so exaggerated, but it's like the German people supporting Hitler, or the people in this country that supported LeMay, who wanted to drop nuclear bombs on Vietnam and was responsible for much of the firebombing during World War II. It's the people that, like those that we see as normal people day in and day out, who empower these folks. They're really the ones who are accountable, and they're the ones that we need to direct our attention to and ultimately provide a better option. And that's exactly what the Justice Party is doing. We did basically sit out this election. We did endorse Bernie Sanders, but we didn't want to do anything that was going to help aid Trump in his election. But we certainly had enormous problems, or at least I do personally, with Hillary Clinton and her warmongering record and her water carrying for Wall Street firms and her essential dishonesty in so many areas. So I think that that we now is a Whig kind of moment where a new party can rise from the ashes of both what used to be the Republican Party and what used to be the Democratic Party and provide a place where people of principle, people who have had it with the corrupting influence of money, can join together and unify around a commitment to economic justice, social justice, and environmental justice.
Well said. Rocky, I'd like to give you seven simple platform ideas, and you tell me what you think of them at the end, all right?
Okay.
To provide federal assistance to low-income communities, to protect Social Security, to provide asylum for refugees, to extend the minimum wage, to improve unemployment benefits so it covers more people, to strengthen labor laws so workers can join a union more easily, and assure equal pay for equal work regardless of sex. Sound reasonable?
Of course it's reasonable. And okay. It's something that I've advocated, that the Justice Party has advocated all the way down the line there. I mean, I'm not sure that you'll see some of the exact words, but minimum wage right now is absolutely absurd when you look at the spending power of the dollar compared with even in the 1960s. We've gone so far backwards in this country, while we've made huge economic strides, but most of the gains have been held by the top 1% and even worse, by the top 0.1%. Working people and the middle class have absolutely been shafted, and that relates to tax policy. You know, we had at the upper incremental tax Eisenhower a 92% tax rate. Now, that didn't cover all that they made. It was only at those incremental levels. But for over 30 years, we had a strong, healthy, vibrant middle class in this country. And starting probably with the Reagan era, that's all been reversed. And we've got a very weak middle class with working people not represented by strong unions. That's another really important factor in seeing this diminution of greater equality, economic equality for people in this country. And then, of course, one of the things you didn't mention, but I think certainly falls within those platform issues and positions, is that we have finally a single-payer health care system. A health care system like the rest of the industrialized world. Now, some places have a socialized system, like in England. Some places have the single-payer system, where we don't depend on the profit-making insurance companies that rip off so many people of the money that ought to be going toward basic health care. And on average, we're spending more than twice per capita what the rest of the developed nations are spending on health care, and yet we have one of the highest infant mortality rates and one of the highest maternal mortality rates in the industrialized world, and it relates directly to the lack of access to health care.
That's part of it, Rocky. By the way, the platform, the seven platform issues I just shared with you, those were the 1956 Republican platform.
Yeah.
You are right. And Eisenhower was more liberal than the Democratic Party has been since. That's not, as a Republican, he also had compassion. But that, then again, We have not had a Roosevelt Democrat. We have not had a Eisenhower Republican who share any of these virtues today. It's all corporatized. And I want to deal a little bit more with that. I want to take you on a little different journey here, and I get your response. This is from Telesur, a very quality source. Quote, more than 10,000 monthly civilians have been killed, and mostly people who are completely unarmed. There are more than 3 million have been displaced in the conflict in Yemen. Whistleblowing organization WikiLeaks dropped yet another batch of files, this time detailing evidence of the United States arming, training, and financing Yemeni forces in the build-up to the current war. The so-called Yemeni files appears to show how the Yemeni government received military hardware from the United States, including aircraft, vehicles, and vessels, as well as the Yemeni procurement of U.S. biometric systems. WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange said in the rarely reported conflict, quote, the United States government has provided most of the bombs and is deeply involved in the conduct of the war itself, end quote. And that's actually on his organization's website. Now, the latest leak of more than 500 documents from the U.S. Embassy in Yemen's communication covers both Hillary Clinton and John Kerry, time as Secretary of State from 2009 to 2015, when the current conflict broke out. The embassy based in the capital of Sana'a closed only a month beforehand. And with U.S. backing, the Saudi-led coalition has been fighting Yemeni's Houthi movement since March 2015. It wants to restore its ally as president, and that is Abed Hadi. Now, he is the favorite of the Saudis. He is a strong Sunni advocate of Wahhabism. But the majority of the people living in this very poor country, the poorest of all the Arab countries, Yemen, are Shia or other sects. And what he would do as president, he would just deny aid. He would deny any kind of help unless you were one of the tribes that he needed.
Right.
And that's why they finally rebelled against him. So here he is, a puppet. We know he's a puppet. Saudi Arabia knows he's a puppet. Everyone knows he's a puppet. And so they throw him out. So instead of trying to look at the situation from the point of view of being a Yemeni and seeing how much you've suffered, how much poverty, how many people died of malnutrition, in comes the United States secretly funding their whole arms to go against these people, the citizens. And
right.
Then you get Saudi Arabia to lead it. Now, the interesting part is the new Secretary of Defense and Minister of Defense in Saudi Arabia, whose father is now the head of Saudi Arabia, an absolute monarchy, he's only about 30, 31, 32 years old, had no experience, and yet he said this war with Yemen would be over in a week.
Yeah.
Well,
does that remind you of?
Yeah, and now it's cost him over $200 billion.
Yeah.
So much money that they've cut back on their own social services and previously free gifts to their own citizens. And still this war is far from over. In fact, it's even gone against them because the Houthis have now started to invade small communities within Saudi Arabia and other communities that were supporting Saudi Arabia, like the United Arab Emirates and Kuwait and Bahrain. In any case, this is what one of the WikiLeaks cables says, quote, that the reason for the United States and Saudi Arabia trying to destroy this country is the following. Saudi Arabia seeks to control a port in Yemen to avoid the potential constriction of its oil shipments by Iran along the Straits of Hormuz or by countries which can control its other oil shipment path along the Red Sea, end quote. So there you have it.
Right.
That there's this narrow choke of land that is in Yemen, and so they went to war because they wanted to control that access. And no one in the media has covered this. Not New York Times, CNN, no one's covered it.
No.
So the new leak, Rocky, sheds further light on what many experts and human rights advocates argue that the coalition is committing war crimes using U.S.-made weapons, and internal warnings have stated that the U.S. would almost certainly be accused of committing war crimes in the conflict through providing logistical and intelligence support to Saudi Arabia coalition. And since 2009, President Obama has made 42 separate weapons deals with Saudi Arabia, totaling $115 billion, according to a report from the Center for International Policy in September.
They're calling the shots, Gary. No question about it. That's why we're in Syria. We are so beholden to Saudi Arabia. And Obama couldn't wait to, I mean, he left his Indian hosts and ran over to Saudi Arabia when he was called to come. And I understand he took Condoleezza Rice with him. But we absolutely, most people in this country have no idea about how Saudi Arabia is calling the shots. The United States is just lining up behind them and inflicting the worst kinds of tragedies on these countries. Yemen, Syria, look what we did in Libya, for heaven's sakes. And having said that, I'd love to discuss this more with you. I told your producer I could only do 15 minutes. I'm supposed to be speaking at the United Nations Association on the destruction of the rule of law and war propaganda in the United States, and I'm going to be late if I get moving. So I hope you got that word. I hate to cut out early, but I'd love to join you again and talk about these issues. Because
Rocky, you represent the coalition of the future. And so in the next few months, I would like for you, Jill Stein, Barry, all of the people who are really progressive to come together and meet and work as a coalition to have a really good, you said second party. I don't believe the Democratic Party can be reformed. It's too corrupt. It's too solidified in greed. But I believe that we could mount a substantial grassroots effort at local levels for the next election cycle. So we look forward to another conversation.
Thank you very much. Good talking to you, Gary.
Thank you, Rocky Anderson. I'm Gary Noll. Now I'm going to share some points of view on Cuba, on Castro. I'm also going to share some audio clips I think you'll find of interest. And then, if you would like to call in on our talkback line, you can do so. That talkback line is 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. First, you have to look at the whole construct of Castro through the eyes of people who have him represent a certain force, a certain ethic, a certain reality. But it depends upon what your own beliefs are and how rigid they are, how inflexible they are, and how pragmatic you are as to whether or not you'll allow any other thoughts in. So those people who believe that he was the savior of the Cuban people, no evidence to the contrary will make a difference. For those people who believe that he was a demon, no evidence to the contrary will make a difference. So that's why I'm saying make up your own mind. But I'll give you both sides of the legacy. First of all, his legacy is extremely mixed. But from an international globalist perspective, he accomplished more positive than anyone before him, certainly the 25-year regime of the Batista government. And he did so against all of the embargoes and sanctions against him. And that raises a existential question. If he did not have embargoes of food and supplies and medicines, how much better off would his country be today? And that has to be kept in the equation. He made Cuba a sovereign nation whose independence is respected internationally. His country has made undeniable social achievements in the field of education and health and culture and sports and international solidarity. He became a symbol of national dignity, someone who is always aligned with the oppressed and all those who fight for their emancipation. It was John F. Kennedy who said, "Fidel Castro is part of the legacy of Bolivar. We should have given a warmer welcome to the fiery young rebel at the moment of his triumph." Arthur Schlesinger, advisor to President Kennedy, noted, Fidel Castro does not encourage the cult of personality. In Havana, it is difficult to find a poster, even a postcard, with a photograph of Castro on it. The icon of Fidel's revolution, the visible everywhere, is Che Guevara. Castro was able to get rid of corruption of the mafia and all of the corrupt parts of the Batista regime. He also stood up against all of the U.S. companies. He nationalized virtually all the Cuban companies. And he also went against the elite Cuban landowners. He distributed their land to hundreds of thousands of Cuban workers. That's not exactly a communist collectivist action. He defied the big landowners such as United Fruit, which is Chiquita, whose employees were essentially indentured serfs. So for those who praise the work before Fidel, you better understand that unless you were associated with the mob or you're giving payoffs to the government, you worked at slave labor. In his autobiography, Fidel said, "If people call me Christian, not from the standpoint of religion, but from the standpoint of social vision, I declare that I am a Christian." By the way, he was an exponent of the idea that Jesus Christ was a communist, citing the feeding of the 5,000 and the story of Jesus and the rich young man as evidence. Castro told Jimmy Carter's envoys in 1978, "It appears that there are two laws, two sets of rules, and two kinds of logic, one for the United States and one for other countries. Perhaps it is the idealistic notion in me, but I never accepted the universal prerogatives of the United States." Clearly, Castro and Cuba use medicine and health as major points. Life expectancy is slightly under that of the United States, which is not good compared to the other 25 major civilized countries that we're behind. And that is in keeping in mind that they were prohibited to having a lot of medicines in Cuba. It is one of the first countries to offer medical aid to disaster-stricken areas. And before 1959, most Cubans had very limited access to health care. The rich elite had their private physicians, but the poor had only a handful of run-down hospitals, and medicines were mostly unaffordable. In the countryside, it was even worse, where health care was virtually non-existent. Today, Cuba has had more doctors per capita than any other country in the world, including the United States, China, and India. It has a lower infant mortality rate than the United States. There are 70,000 doctors in Cuba, 30,000 abroad, 40,000 in residence. There are 90,000 Cuban students currently studying to work in healthcare. Cuba trains free of charge 76,000 foreign students in medicine. It has a flourishing biotechnology and pharmaceuticals industry today. And in 2008, 36,500 Cuban doctors were sent to 81 third world countries to provide healthcare to the people who would otherwise not have received it. More doctors than what the World Health Organization or all the rich countries provide to the third world, Cuba provided. With education, the first and greatest of revolutionary Cuba's achievements is in education, was the abolition of illiteracy, which stood at 23% in 1958. A mass literacy campaign led by 280,000 volunteers teaching some 100,000 students eliminated illiteracy in just 1 year. Preschool to PhD is free education. It's guaranteed both in the Cuban Constitution and in all the declarations. And the cost of tutoring and books and pencils and pens are socialized. Cuba has more teachers per capita than any other country in the world. With women's rights, Cuban women were also at the bottom of the social pyramid in pre-revolutionary Cuba. By 2002, 62% of university graduates were women. Women constitute 65% of Cuba's professional and technical workers, 51% of scientific researchers, and 72% of all medical doctors are women. 49% of parliament is made up of women. Now, the LGBT issues originally All gays were banned, persecuted, and killed, imprisoned. But in 1986, the Cuban government began a conscious campaign to combat homophobia. In 1992, Castro called it natural if you were homosexuals. Homosexuality was made legal, and the government sponsored attempts to eradicate homophobia ideas in the broader Cuban society. But that didn't really get into effect until about 10 years later. In the environment in the early 1990s, Cuba started environmental campaigns against global warming long before the United States did, and also the focus on the waste of natural resources. It accused the United States of being the world's primary polluter. In 1994, Cuba started a ministry dedicated to the environment and new laws promoting awareness of environmental issues throughout Cuba. It stressed the sustainable use of natural resources. And by 2006, Cuba was the world's only nation which met the UN Development Program's definition of sustainable, the only one in the world. As far as agriculture, Havana, with 20% of Cuba's population, is the focus of the urban food production experiment. By the mid-1990s, there were more than 20,000 urban gardens in just Havana, cultivated by 50 to 100,000 people. Organic agricultural methods for food production was made Havana law. Today, most of Havana's food is produced in the city itself. In fact, USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack said, "I think they, the Cuban growers, have an incredible opportunity in the future to be a major supplier of value-added organic products, simply because they have not utilized modern agriculture processes, have not used chemicals and pesticides and so forth that have been used in the other parts of the world, including the United States. When the Soviet Union collapsed, Cuba lost its main supplier of fertilizers and pesticides and built a largely organic farming system." And one final thing involving debt. Castro denounced the third world debt problem, arguing that the third world would never escape the debt that first world banks and governments imposed upon it. In 2005, Hugo Chavez founded the Bolivarian Alliance for the Peoples of our America, the Bolivarian, I should say, which now includes 8 countries in Latin America and the Caribbean. In Somalia, Tanzania, Mozambique, and Angola, Castro is a hero, one of the first to oppose apartheid in South Africa and throughout much of Africa, when many of us were protesting in front of the South African embassy. The media was not covering it, and it was not an issue in the mainstream at all. Long before that, Castro had made apartheid a major issue. Havana became a beacon, a sponsor, and a mischief maker for revolutionary causes. It gave assistance to the Algerian rebels fighting the French colonists in 1961. In Zaire, Cubans led by Che Guevara engaged 1,000 CIA-backed mercenaries. So you see, on the one hand, we must acknowledge that these have made a big difference in Cuba. But at the same time, we must also be honest and look at the truth that there's another side to Cuba and to Castro. And I'll get to my personal visit to Cuba, where I had a chance to meet with and be driven around. And I went from one end of Cuba to the other. And by the way, Cuba's big. You could put Cuba over California and you wouldn't see California. That's how big it is. So I had a chance to stay with Cuban families, saw how they lived, had a chance to meet with them, hear their stories, young and old. Fidel used firing squads to enforce discipline that led to a reign of terror. Even while he was a rebel, he did this. The Cuba archive documents 5,000 firing squad executions by 1970, as well as 2,100 political executions. However, that is just a gross understatement. because more reliable sources, it's at least 17,000 executions, and one person told me it's well over 20,000 because his parents were the judges, and I'll explain what happened there in a little bit. Che Shavero is one of his chief enforcers. Che personally executed over 100 people, and later he used only capital punishment for serious crimes, including drug trafficking. I'll come back to that idea of drug trafficking in a moment. But you also have to look at the DiMarzo tugboat incident. He sank a tugboat with 72 escapees from his island. These were people who couldn't live there anymore. 41 died, including 10 children. He downed an unarmed U.S.-Cuban civilian aircraft trying to locate rafters stuck in the sea. They all died. Also, the national austerity after the collapse of the Soviet Union, which had been subsidizing Cuba since the early 1960s, caused food scarcity, rationing, and people trying to immigrate, and they were prevented from immigrating. But still, taking their life in their own hands, between 1959 and 1993, 1.2 million Cubans left by small boats and rafts. In the military units, in aid to production, he created forced labor camps for re-education, much like the Pol Pot did in Cambodia with the Khmer Rouge. So if you refuse to volunteer for the revolution, like Jehovah's Witnesses did, or Seventh-day Adventists did, or conscientious people, and you refuse collectivization, then you were sent to a long re-education camp where you're given bare-bone minimum survival and no freedoms at all. There were at least 30,000 Cubans who were interned just at one point in prisons, and they also used psychiatry. From 1959, for decades, Cuba would put any dissident into a psychiatric hospital, giving them electroconvulsive therapy, keeping them on severe medications, and creating tardive dyskinesia and other side effects. So if you were a political opponent or perceived to be one, then you could end up much like Solzhenitsyn and others. There was no free speech in Cuba, none. The irony of it is many of the people who have a right to speak and do so, and rightly so, and are angered by a lot of the corruption in our political system, a lot of the corruption of the pay-for-play. You said anything in Cuba that reflected poorly upon the government, the revolution, or Castro, you would have all freedom taken away. You would be arrested. You would be put into the camps, and you might be shot. No freedom of speech. The government claims that it does exist, but I can tell you it does not. And because they want to keep with the rules of revolution. Also, the restrictions of assembly, especially if you were a political person and you wanted to assemble with some dissidents, if you wanted to open up an independent trade union, you could not. There were harsh limitations on travel, and hence people could not easily get out of the country, even if they had the resources to do so. And also, all property that they valued was confiscated. For example, one of the first things he did is he went into the churches, Fidel himself, and he would ask a kid, pray for food. You're hungry, pray for food. Go ahead, pray. And then he said, well, did God give you food? No, but we will. So he knew that he could only succeed in the long term if he indoctrinated the children. So one of the first educational programs was an indoctrination program of all the children to believe that there was no God and that the church was evil and that he must trust the people. And it got so bad that children for decades were conditioned to listen for everything that their parents or anyone at home might say. And if they said anything that their teachers or instructors told them was seditious, that they were to report that, and they did. As a result, a lot of families were arrested, members of families, because a child went to school and said, well, I heard my mom or dad say this. If someone liked your property, they would simply take it. Even if you had nothing to do with Batista, you were not rich, you just had a nice house, gone. And one of the, now, also keep in mind that when Fidel entered on New Year's Eve, 1959, into Havana, Batista fled. Batista had been there for 25 years. He was one of our puppet regimes. The mob was controlling virtually all the nightclubs and gambling casinos in Cuba, and a lot of the drug trafficking. And if you wanted to do business, you had to do a public-private relationship, what we would call that today, meaning you could open up a business, but you had to kick back money to Batista and his different deputies and those who were in his circle. And that money never trickled down to the population. You had freedoms to an extent depending upon your class, where you were in the social order. And as long as you didn't represent or support in anything considered communist or Marxist. And so one of the first things that happened was the people came out and cheered. Hundreds of thousands of people who came from the business class, they might have had a bakery, they might have had a butcher shop, school teachers, all kinds of people came out and cheered. Many wealthy people actually cheered because they were against Batista, because Batista had a constant shakedown racket going on. So if you didn't like doing business with Batista, he'd put you out of business. He would just show up one day with someone who says, you're in violation, you do not have these permits, close down your factory. And that's how he worked. And by the way, our State Department, our CIA knew this. Everyone knew this who was in a position of power. If you wanted to go to the Sin City of the world, you didn't go to Las Vegas, which was just starting at that time. You went to Cuba. You went to Havana, only 90 miles away off our shore. So here are all these people cheering him because they believe the revolution would be a real revolution to bring equality and the rule of law and opportunity for everyone. And one of the very first things that happened was that there were people coming in, and if you had any affiliations at all, or you were suspected, you were shot. Now, they went through a mockery, much like the Soviets did. The Soviets did a little more show trials, but these were not even show trials. And thousands upon thousands were simply taken out and killed. But let's say that you owed someone money. You would simply say that person is a Batista supporter or someone who is very capitalistic, and that person be taken out and shot. Eisenhower was the one who wanted to see very quickly, would Castro come around and do business with the United States? If Castro had said, I'm going to let all these industries that are here stay, we'll just reorganize how the profit is shared, there wouldn't be any attack against Castro at all. There were hundreds of attacks against his life. So that was the first stage, great deal of violence. And then people started to see that slowly but surely, businesses were taken over, homes were confiscated, and so people began to realize that there was another part to this revolution. So they began to sneak the children out. There was a Pan Am flight every day to Miami. And they had put 2 to 3 kids at a time on, no more. They had no one to help them, really, and they didn't know anyone. They didn't have any family in Miami. Miami wasn't Cuban at that time. So the Catholic Church took the kids off the plane and put them into homes. There were shelters. But the kids are 3, 4, 5, 10, 12 years old. They didn't know a single person in the United States. They had no resources. A total of 14,000 kids were secreted out of the country, parents believing that something might change and that everything would go back to being at least peaceful. It didn't happen. A lot of the parents then tried to get out. A lot couldn't make it. And it took years for many of the kids to meet their parents again. Some of these kids were taken to California and put in foster homes. You talk about really affecting you psychologically. Imagine you're a little kid. Your mom and dad put you on a plane. You end up in a place you've never seen. You're taken to a place where they hold you for a year in a boarding room, boarding school. Then you're sent off to a family, and that's supposed to be your new parents. Now, a year later, your parents get out, and you have to reunite with them. And the people got out, made sure that the government made sure they took nothing with them. And in fact, there was a period of time where the government wanted people to leave because they considered these people not a part of the revolution. They called them bourgeois. They called them capitalist. And so the people left with nothing. So just remember that. Remember, you better pull back the curtain and look at the whole story, not just what you've been programmed to believe is the truth. So that just gives you a little background. So then when I went to Cuba, what I found was that the hospital that was used by Michael Moore in Sicko to make it look like they have great health care, free to everyone, walk in with any condition, it's taken care of by the best doctors. Well, it's not really the way the story is told by the people in Cuba. A doctor who was my driver and translator told me that it was all prepped. He said, the reality is that most of these hospitals, you have to save up your money, which could take you a year before you can buy your own medications. You have to take your medications in the hospital with you because there are frequently no medications there. There's long waiting lists, he said. And he was paid $39 a month, which was actually higher than most of the workers who were making $20 a month. And so you really have empathy and for the fact that here is a person, I won't give you more about his identity because I don't want any reprisals, but he was in a position to know everything about the medical society and the hospitals in Cuba. And he said they just do not have the supplies because of the embargoes, but also because there was a big error in judgment. Castro did not bring in the medicines they needed. He brought in arms. The money that went to from first Russia for all those decades and then China after that, it wasn't a lot of what they needed. And he said, look, you know, look at the poor people. So I was dropped off at this guy's house, little tiny house. First thing I noticed when I walk in the door, I love the Cuban people. The Cuban people are wonderful human beings, just as nice and open and curious and a gazillion questions as you could imagine. And also it's very rare for an American to stay in their homes. They stay in the beautiful beach resorts that are filled with not people from America because you can't go there to, you know, take a vacation. But if you were from Canada or Germany, oh, yeah. And so here's this very humble house with only two pieces of furniture. It had two bedrooms, small, and nothing worked. No fan. Forget air conditioners. The fan didn't work. It was very hot and humid. And it would look like two pieces of outdoor furniture that had been brought inside. That's all he had. And a little tiny table. But while he's talking, I see him in the kitchen. He's got a little piece of meat. And when I went to look, it was pork. And he's cutting it with a razor blade. And that was his whole monthly allowance that the government gives him, his rations. And I said, hold on. I said, friend, let me make you something. I said, I don't eat that. And so he would, mind you, a total stranger, was willing to give me his own food. I mean, who does that? A lot of people around the world do that, as my experience has been. But anyhow, I had a chance to have a talk. We talked almost all night. And he told me about there's two types of Cubans. There's the older Cubans who grew up in the revolution, who supported the revolution and believe in Fidel and believe in what he's done. They're the older revolution that grew up who did not believe in Fidel and who saw the repressions and lived in constant fear because the spies were everywhere. Every phone was tapped. In every hotel, there's someone sitting there. They're monitoring everything. And he said, if you go to the beach, any beach in Cuba, do not say hello to any woman that walks up to you. Even if it seems completely innocent, they come up and say, hi, you know, could you take a picture of my friend and I? Don't do it. Because what you don't see is that the Cuban police are waiting to come over to give the woman a ticket in front of you for $100. And $100 is a year's worth of money for this person. And the intent is for you to pay for the person's ticket. Or they tell you, you know, you're here, you know, what do you think, we're a sex capital like Bangkok? And so then they put you in a predicament of feeling guilty because someone that just said hello to you is getting fined who's dirt poor. So you take out the money and you give it to the police. And then you realize they're going to do that 100 times that day. But they're all over the island doing this. Also, when we talked, he brought in some friends. And one of the statements was, we are told that there is no racism in Cuba. They all laughed. Everybody laughed when I asked him that. Why? Well, it depends. If you're dark-skinned, oh, there's definitely prejudice. If you're light-skinned, no. And then they gave examples of the kind of jobs, who gets the jobs and who does not, and who gets favors, who does not. And he said, as long as you are favored, as long as you have living conditions that you like, you're going to support the revolution, you're going to support Castro, because you're part of that permanent bureaucracy. But he said, now try to get anything done in Cuba, anything, and see how hard it is. It's got one of the worst bureaucracies in the world. So I had a chance to talk with a lot of people in the community, and I was very grateful for this man. So the next day, I went to the local farmer's market, where there's a lot of these, and I loaded up with everything I could possibly fit in the van, took it back and gave it to this man as a gift, and gave him some cash. And I said, I really appreciate your opening up. And he said, well, I could open up because we're talking in my house, and I know that the conversation won't go further. That happened all week. That happened for that next 10 days. That's all I did, is talk with average Cubans. And then I noticed something. No matter where you go, you're going to find a younger generation that wants to get off the island. They're very limited. They're very poor. There's very little they can do. There's very few opportunities because of how much restrictions there are. And then there are a lot of people, mainly younger people, who are very innovative. They have great ideas. They want to do things, but they're prevented from doing it. Now, just slightly opening up some opportunities to grow some foods, because for decades you couldn't grow foods and sell them. You know, whatever you grew, you had to give to the government, who would then, like in Russia, distribute it, and that's always a mess. But now, for example, they're allowing you to own a little business, just one little business, and a very small business. So, for example, there is a brother and sister that opened up a bakery in their garage. And they would normally, they're both professionals, and they would both earn, she is a physician, by the way, about $25 to $30 a month. They make that each day from their bakery, because who knew all these people wanted fresh baked goods? But there were no fresh baked goods. Now they get them. So all over the island, you have just a boom of people opening little tiny businesses for the first time. Now, we're talking about right now as I'm speaking. And because don't believe the propaganda. Remember, they have a huge ministry of propaganda. It's as bad as our CIA for propaganda. So those are just some of the insights. And that there is a dark legacy to Cuba and Castro, and there's an enlightened legacy to Castro and Cuba. And it's where we go from here that matters. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more in the next program. Have a nice day.
Party, man.
Yeah,
I can dig it.
Stop right on.